Good morning. So we continue making our way through the readings from the book of Romans, the epistle readings. And today, as we get to chapter 11, we're kind of reaching sort of an inflection point or a transition. Because after chapter 11, Paul starts getting just really practical. As if to say, okay, I've laid out this whole thing for 11 chapters. We added the chapter numbers later. And then when you get to chapter 12, he says, therefore, this is how it ought to impact the way that you live and exist. But we're not there yet. So next week, we'll get intensely practical. But for now, we get to round out this big picture that Paul is painting. Except there's something that I've kind of withheld, much to my own internal pain, because it has actually a lot to do with some of the research and writing I did for grad school. And I, for an academically oriented person, that is really hard to not talk constantly about. But to go back first to the arc of Romans 1 through 11, Paul addressing the Jewish and Gentile church in the city of Rome. They had been separated for a while, we don't know exactly how long, and now they're coming back together and trying to figure out how to exist as a community. And they're apparently tearing themselves apart based on their identity. You've got Gentiles who had learned to kind of function as Christians or followers of Jesus without the help of their Jewish brothers and sisters. And now those Jewish brothers and sisters have returned. They're kind of used to knowing the scriptures and being that resource. And so now we've got conflict. Never would have thought there'd be conflict in the church, right? That's weird. It never happens in modern day. And so the way that he gets at this is first by telling this big story of God as God has worked in and through history to bring them to the moment of salvation, really to the unveiling of Jesus. And that, for right off the bat, is a really big positive thing about being Jewish. And Paul, as a Jewish man, is very clear on this. Like, it was our privilege to bear and carry this promise forward that was made to our ancestors. And the Gentiles, he said, yeah, they weren't given anything, but there are reasons why or things to suspect that in creation that should reflect that there is a creator. But the Gentiles did Gentile things. We'll just leave it at that. However, he would also say his fellow kinsmen, fellow Israelites, were given the promises and expectations and they didn't do great, or from Paul's perspective, we did not do well. In fact, the history of Israel is one of constant tragedy, often at their own hands. And then he works his way into the coming of the Messiah, which everyone was waiting for, at least within the Jewish world, but nobody suspected that the Messiah would die. And then no one really expected that he would be raised from the dead. And then he started to make all these connections that when we are baptized, we are buried with Jesus in that baptism. We die with him, something very fundamental about us does. And then when Jesus brings death, he brings life. So then we are raised with Jesus as well. And that becomes the basis for their identity, which is something we're going to come back to. And then he uses that to explain, like, therefore, there's no difference. Like, and we as human beings are tribal beings. We are much more comfortable when we can draw lines and boundaries, whether literal or by metaphor or whatever, that keeps us away from others that are a little different from us. And what Paul is saying is, no, that is all nonsense, whether it's ethnicity or anything else. It doesn't matter. We are all together in Jesus. And then he works his way into the great chapter, chapter 8, which begins with, there is therefore no condemnation for those who are in Jesus. All of our sin and destruction has been wiped away. And he ends that chapter with, there is nothing that can separate us from the love of God. And then moving into 9, 10, and 11, Paul then has to address this issue where his own kinsmen, at least some of them, have rejected Jesus. Now, by this point, the church, if we can call it that, is almost entirely Jewish. So he does not mean all of the nation of Israel has rejected the coming of the Messiah. That's nonsense. But plenty have. And this broke Paul's heart that his own people have missed their moment, at least for now. And so he goes on to explain, how his own people still bear the promise. They have borne the promise into history, and so on and so forth. And then as we get closer to chapter 11, and as we've talked about it over the last couple of weeks, we started asking questions like, what do you do when you find that the story of your life is not the story you thought it was? And God apparently had other things in mind. And that's when I think a life of faith really shows its fruit. That if we can, in our faith, account for suffering and struggle, then there's nothing that can shake us. If a life of faith in our own minds means that we will not suffer, then when suffering inevitably comes, we fall apart. And so now we get to chapter 11. And as I said, and the reading here is tricky because it kind of picks a couple of verses here and there. And honestly, I get why, because chapter 11 is so dense, it would take us like 4 weeks just to get through it minimum. We're not going to do that. But this whole time, and it would take a while to explain, so I guess this is just one of those, trust me, and if you don't, email me and we can work through it, is that Paul senses something coming. He's not extremely explicit about it. He doesn't say these things are going to happen. But as he's writing, you get this sense, and it's a little subtle, that he is first off aware that Jesus as a prophet, and Jesus was a prophet, he was a few other things, but he was a prophet, had predicted that destruction is coming on Jerusalem, the holy city, and the temple, which if you are Jewish, is the core of your identity. It is the place where God is present. It is the place where your people, as historically, have had the privilege of tending to and taking care of God's very presence. It is the center of the universe, quite literally. Now, Paul seems to be aware that Jesus has predicted this, but he also has spent lots of time in Judea. And if you have an eye for it, if you read through like the story of Acts, which includes a lot of Paul's ministry, you can see destabilization happening over time in Jerusalem. Things start to get a little more frenetic, a little scary, a little unstable. I mean, it sounds weird to say it like this, but it turns out Jesus was right. I know, it's like, turns out he was. And it's hard to know what Paul knows, but it seems clear that he senses something coming. Now, war will break out in the year 66. A group of Jewish rebels will storm the city. They will take over the temple complex, burn the debt records stored there, which is weird that they're there. That's for another time. They will then very darkly, publicly execute the high priest. And I say darkly because I never want to ever rejoice over the death of anybody. He also had it coming. Just going to say that. And then a bunch of infighting broke out. And eventually, as Jerusalem collapses into chaos, the Roman army comes. And the Roman army killed a lot of people. And even scarier is that there are some estimates that suggest that Jewish people died at the hands of their fellow kinsmen just as much as the Romans. In the words of W.B. Yeats, the Irish poet, things fell apart. It seems like Paul senses that this is coming. Word has gotten to him. And you can, again, you can see it in some of his letters. You can see it in the book of Acts. The crazy thing is that Paul is executed before this happens. And boy, we have loved his insight after those events. But he doesn't live that long. He is executed unjustly, I think, at the hands of the Roman Empire. That's going to come into focus when we get to chapter 13, by the way. So as Paul is talking through, he's talking at Tertius, who's writing all of this down, in chapter 11, he is continuing this theme of the tragedy that is his fellow kinsman. And he makes it very clear, this is an internal debate. He himself is Jewish, of the tribe of Benjamin, which is rare that he could actually trace his lineage that way. And yet he weeps over the fact that everything seems to be taken away from them, his fellow people. And he yearns for this moment, this day, when they all come to realize that Jesus is, in fact, who he said he was. He's the Messiah. He's the Son of God. Now, this brings up all kinds of other questions that I either don't have time to go into or, honestly, I don't know. There's a lot of thought, and this is more of an American evangelical thing, and if that doesn't make any sense to you, just ignore it, to draw then a direct line between what Paul is writing here and the modern state of Israel, and I don't think that's really justified. Modern state of Israel is a different thing. But it does raise all kinds of questions about the rest of God's chosen people who've been given the honor to bear the promise. And I don't have a whole lot of answers to that. And I get the sense that Paul doesn't either. Because he understands that his own kinsmen, to some extent, are under some kind of judgment. And you see that starting to play out already just in history. There's this growing anger amongst his fellow kinsmen because this was a period of time marked by the wealthy becoming incredibly wealthy, while the poor and the maybe what we might call middle class, although that was pretty thin, are just becoming poorer and poorer. Not at all like today, right? These things don't happen anymore. anyway, I should stop right now. Anyway, but there was also a strain of very dangerous, violent nationalism that was bubbling up and kind of threatening to boil over the top, and it eventually does in 66. And as all of this is playing out, Paul has the audacity to say to his fellow brothers and sisters, both kinsmen and in Jesus, in Rome, that those identities don't matter anymore. And just because you are under judgment or people are under God's judgment does not mean that God has abandoned them. That's a very important point that actually kind of hits home for us today. Sometimes, I don't know if you've experienced this, but sometimes life just goes horribly wrong. Or life gets really hard. Life takes some turns that you did not predict. And maybe I'm the only one, but sometimes that all happens because of the poor choices that I have made. We might say in those situations that we or I or whatever are under judgment. Judgment, however, does not mean abandonment. Judgment and justice are effectively the same word in the ancient languages of the Bible. Just like if a parent disciplines a child, that means that they are still engaged with them and seeking to raise them and shape them in the way that they need to be shaped. It's the parent who has given up that is a different story. Or in any relationship, really. I mean, relationships take effort to maintain. And it's the relationship where one or both of the parties don't care anymore that that relationship's in trouble. And as Paul is laying this out, and this is more the broad picture of chapter 11, even the parts we didn't read, that is kind of Paul's point. Like, he has not abandoned us. And in fact, he's come nearer to us than we ever could have imagined. That was last week's reading. Jesus is now present in the way that the temple was supposed to be, because we, in fact, are the temple of God. We are the place where God has chosen to place his presence. That's a really big deal. And now, Paul has to raise a bunch of questions that don't really have answers about identity. Because up until that moment, his fellow kinsmen lived in and based their lives around this identity that they are the bearers of God's promise. They are the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they had the privilege of living in the holy city and the privilege of approaching the very presence of God in the temple, and that's all going to go away. Now, I think Paul doesn't exactly know how that's going to look, but if you pressed him, I'm sure he would say, Jerusalem's walls are coming down and the temple is going to be wiped off the map. And he would say that probably because he's familiar with what Jesus said. What this suggests to us, and this is where I kind of want to land for today, is what do you do when your identity is stripped? I guess we should back up. Where do you find your identity? Kind of beg the question with that first question on purpose. Because if I were to go around right now and ask you, where do you find your identity? I think most of you would have the sense of, okay, this is a pastor asking me this, and we're literally in church, so I'm supposed to say Jesus. Just like any statistics involving self-reported church membership and attendance are just by very nature wrong. Because we know we're supposed to say we go to church, so it's like, I think I went to that church like 6 years ago, so yeah, I'll say that one. That's why statistics around church attendance are really tough. To be accurate. But nonetheless, if we weren't in church and it wasn't a pastor asking you a very pointed question about your identity, where would you find your identity? And finding your identity in things is not wrong. Like, you're human. That's how it works. I can find my identity as a husband, as a father, as somebody who loves and practices Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I try really hard not to talk about it too much, because we would talk about it a lot. As a musician, as a pastor, as a software engineer. Those are roughly the categories that I kind of latch on to. What about you? Parents, professionals, teachers, doctors, lawyers, members of your community, people with good reputation, a neighbor, that weird person who lives on the street where your house is just immaculately kept outside and in. I do not understand you, but I respect it. As a student, as an engineer, as a mom, as a dad, as a grandparent, great-grandparent, where do you find your identity? Now notice, none of these things are bad. In fact, often they can be very positive forces in our lives. The problem is that they can all be taken away. Take a silly example, like, you know, I love jiu-jitsu. And it's funny watching the older guys, like me. I mean, yeah, I'm like usually one of the oldest guys on the mat. Look at like some of the younger guys who would be like, yeah, I hurt my neck and I kind of got tingly in my arm, but I'm just going to power through it. And the older guys go, don't do that. No, take time off, please. Because we know what injury will do later. And honestly, I've seen jiu-jitsu careers end in front of me through injury. It can just vanish instantly. If you're a spouse, God forbid, but that can be taken away in all kinds of ways. If you're a parent, I mean, again, God forbid, but what if there's a break in my relationship with my son for some reason and we stop speaking? Again, God forbid. That's going to change things. Sometimes if you are a professional and your identity is rooted in that profession, it becomes very hard to retire. Pastors are notorious for this. And I've known enough to know or to be able to identify, it's because it's really hard to give up that identity. Because then what else do you have? And as Paul is talking through and all of these issues about some kind of vague coming catastrophe, but also just the tragedy that there's been a mixed response on by his own kinsmen to Jesus, he is, whether we realize it or not, picking at the different ways that we have, or that his people have formed their identity on anything other than Jesus. Which is why now, hopefully, certain phrases that I've thrown out that Paul has written in Romans might take on slightly different, might have a slightly different, different feel. Like there's nothing that can separate us from the love of God. There are all kinds of things that can separate us from literally everything else. It takes one bad diagnosis to lose everything. Human life and identity hangs by a thread. But as Paul has laid out this big picture of God coming down to reaching out to humanity in order to save us, he's made at least one thing clear. Jesus is now present. And therefore, God is now present in a way he had not previously been. And can anything separate us from the love of God that is in the Messiah Jesus? No. Now, hopefully, to some extent, nobody here has experienced just a total loss of everything that they found their identity in. And I say hopefully because that's probably, there are enough people here that that's probably happened to a few of you, a few of us. And it's a miserable experience. If it is experienced through the lens that nothing can separate us from the love of God that is in Jesus, and with this astonishing revelation that Paul is explaining in chapter 10 mostly, that Jesus is now present in a way that God has been present in his temple and with his people. But the difference is that Jesus' presence cannot and will not depart from us. Well then, if I lose everything, I still have Jesus. And Jesus has this, he doesn't promise it with his words, he does it by his actions. Whenever Jesus brings death, and to that extent, in that sense, loss of identity, loss of ability, loss of a sense of place in this world, Jesus always brings life. And if we have everything stripped away from us, God forbid, with that perspective, we will often emerge much stronger, much more rooted in what God has done for us in Jesus, much more rooted in what it means to have God's very presence within us and among us. And so if I could sum up the entirety of Romans 1 through 11, I would do it like this. We, in spite of all of our many differences and coming from all kinds of different places and different opinions, different walks of life, so on and so forth, We are all the very temple of God. And God has promised that his presence will not depart. So what happens when everything is taken away from you? You still have that. And that's the only thing that actually matters. Amen. Please rise as you are able.